Great. Well, we'll make a start. Thanks for coming along for this seminar on dealing with disappointment. We're going to be a bit more interactive. I will be doing some teaching, but you've done well. It's late in the afternoon. Supper is coming. So we want to make sure that we stay awake. I'm going to pray for us as we start thinking together about this topic of dealing with disappointment. Gracious Father, you are all that we need. You are a wonderful God of hope and peace and joy and life and comfort and glory and love. And we pray that in the minutes we have together now, as we discuss together, as we contemplate, as we talk, as we look at your word, that you would help us to gain a right understanding and perspective on the disappointments of our lives, and that though they loom large, we would see Christ greater and better and more real than our disappointments. Amen. I'd like you to start in little groups where you're sitting, three, four, whatever works best for you. You'll see there's a box at the top of the handout that says discuss. What were your hopes? What are your hopes? What makes life satisfying? How have you been disappointed? Please don't feel you have to be more specific than you'd like, particularly if the person you're sitting next to is the disappointment. I wrote a book. This material comes from a book that I wrote called Dealing with Disappointment. And as I was writing it, my editor said, could you use some more personal illustrations? I said, the problem is that disappointment is almost always people. They're almost always in relationship. But the nature of a disappointment is it's not always the sort of thing you have out with someone. So I said, it feels a bit mean to have it out in print. I did think it'd be quite funny. You know, some of those books are dedicated. I thought, yeah, dedicated to, you know, my wife, without whom this book would never have been written. You know, you could. Anyway, why don't you spend a couple of minutes just discussing those questions together. Be as a kind of personal as you like, but don't feel you have to be. Got 5 minutes. Let's say 5 minutes. I'm going to cut into your discussions. We're not going to particularly feed back on that. I just thought it would help us to get in the territory. Because I think that disappointment is a particular and strange form of suffering. I also think it's pretty much universal, at least as you get older. And what's strange about it is that it's not acute suffering. So if you're in your home group and you're sharing needs in your life for prayer, someone might say, well, there are going to be redundancies in my department. I'm concerned, can we pray that I keep my job? We've just taken on a mortgage. This is a serious matter for our family. And you think, yeah, we'll pray about that. But it feels hard to say, well, I just hoped that by this point in my life, I'd be more senior. I'd have achieved more in my profession. It's a hard thing because you kind of think, well, how can I say that when someone else is facing losing their job? It just feels a bit self-absorbed. Or someone says, I'd love to be married. Love to find a wife. I love Christ. I love being part of the church. I love church family. But it would be, I just long for marriage. And it feels hard to go, well, I'm just a bit disappointed in my marriage. It's okay. Yeah, it's not that my wife's awful. I'm not even sure it's her. I just had higher hopes. It's just very hard. But partly it's hard because you feel like it's unfair. You know, it's not that my wife's doing anything terrible or she's letting me down and I think the one might even be me. And I don't want her to feel bad. I don't want others to think badly of her. That's not fair. It's not awful. There's no great trauma. We're not struggling. It's not on the rocks. But I don't know, how do I voice that? It's hard to talk about these things. I just wish our family life was closer. You know, the children are okay. They love the Lord. They're doing well at school. They're not. But we just seem to lack a closeness that I'd hoped for. And it just makes me sad. And I just think it's worth delving into, because I see a lot of it round about. I see it in my life, I see it in the church. Interestingly, I also see it in my friends. And we'll come to this a bit later, but I think thinking about this is important evangelistically as well as for us, because I think the world is full of disappointed people. I remember hearing a few years back the American preacher John Piper say, never underestimate the bitterness carried by the average 60-year-old man. And I thought, really? You think, I was surprised. Just and getting older and pastoring a church where there are older people and getting to know their friends particularly, yeah, there is a lot of bitterness, a lot of regret. You know, the kind of je ne regrette rien. You know, actually, very few say that. Most people carry quite a lot of regrets. So let's start off. And the first side of the handout, basically, we're going to look at what disappointment is and what the Bible says about it. The second side, I think, is some ways to give it some hope and some perspective. But not to get rid of it, because actually, I think we should be disappointed. That's the funny thing about disappointment. I think we should be disappointed. Sometimes we should be more disappointed than we are. And I'm going to read some words from the beginning of Ecclesiastes. Do turn there, but if you prefer just to listen, they're really powerful and poetic, and they work quite well to listen to. So depending on how tired you're feeling, you may feel that just listening to something would send you to sleep at this point. But Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil of which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and all that has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen what is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. Ecclesiastes is the book of disappointment. It is brutally realistic about life in this world. Solomon, as he writes it, he investigates every avenue of meaning and pleasure and declares vanity, 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 breath, meaninglessness, nothingness. This is a world that is full of disappointment. And in Romans chapter 8, Paul tells us why. Romans chapter 8, verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. It's funny, I actually learned this morning that the word Paul uses there for futility, Paul was telling me, is the same word that Solomon uses in Ecclesiastes for vanity. the Hebrew is translated into the Greek Old Testament, and Paul uses that word as he writes in the Greek of Romans. And the creation has been subjected to futility, to meaninglessness, to vanity by God, so that we realize that there is something deeply and fundamentally wrong with this world that is our sin. C.S. Lewis said something like, if you long for a better world, the reason is probably that you were made for a better world. That you, when the children come to the new land in the last battle, it's like Narnia, but better. This is what Narnia should have been. This is the world as it should have been. This world is meant to be disappointing because our sin has broken everything. When Adam first sinned, he threw creation into disarray and brought in corruption and decay and meaninglessness. Beautiful, fruitful work became thorns and thistles and sweat and toil. And we need to, we should probably be more disappointed. I think there's a danger that we live in paradise in some ways. We are healthy, we are wealthy. You know, compared to history and geography, we enjoy health and wealth that is almost unknown across the world. I read the other day there are 2.4 million people in generational debt slavery working in the brick kilns in northern India. 2.4 million people. Yeah, that is 10 times the numbers we're trying to reach in North Norfolk. And I think, you know, I have in my wallet, as I stand here, more money than a family would earn in a year in that work. You think we are so wealthy, so privileged, that the number of shirts I have in my wardrobe, you know, I have more than one pair of shoes. How many people don't have one? You think, you know, I have a bicycle and a car. How many people would love a bicycle? It's incredible. We should see just how fallen this world is. We should find it more desperate. We should long for the days when Christ returns. We'll come back to that. But in other ways, we are too disappointed. A few years back, we decided we would have a trampoline and we would make it ground level, because we'd seen this on the internet and it seemed like a great idea. Which basically means you dig a trampoline-sized hole in your garden, which we did. We couldn't get a mini digger into the garden, so Steve, one of my fellow elders, who was a wonderful friend in helping me, he calculated that we dug and barrowed 11 tons of earth by hand. and when we'd finished, we realized that we hadn't dug the hole like that. We dug it ever so slightly like that, which meant there was a lovely 6-inch kind of catch your foot and break your leg gap around the trampoline when we put it in. So we lifted it out again, and I sat in the hole, literally and metaphorically, just feeling so low and downcast that all this work had been for nothing. And then a friend who's a builder did us a bit of concrete to reinforce it, and it's great. It's wonderful to have. If I'd known how much work it would be, I would never have done it. I was so disappointed. I was in tears, which is embarrassing to admit, but I sat in the hole and I cried because I just felt so downcast that we'd done all this work, and probably I thought at that point we probably needed to fill it in, but the soil had already gone because we'd got a grab lorry to come and take it. So I was like, I'm going to have to pay for soil to fill in the hole. it was too much. You know, we are too disappointed. That should be a bit disappointing, but it shouldn't have left me so despairing. And And I want to say this carefully, but that is true even of things that should be deeply disappointing. So something that I've got friends for whom this is deep disappointment. I have friends who would love to be married. Friends where I can't, it is beyond me why they're not married. Godly, beautiful, kind, warm, generous men and women. And I think, why aren't you married? And I know you'd love to be. And it is a deep disappointment to them. But even something that is rightly a disappointment can become the thing that colours everything. Can become the central way of understanding our life. It's not just that. It can be the failure of a relationship, a hard and painful divorce, or a breakdown between parents and children, or brothers and sisters. It can be, a job you longed to do, or a position you longed to get to, that you never made, and you just think, maybe I never will. And it becomes the but that colours everything. You're at work on Monday, and someone says, oh, how was your weekend? You say, I had a great weekend. I went away with my church family. Oh, this beautiful house in Norfolk, Letton Hall, is beautiful. Were you in Norfolk or were you in Suffolk? Norfolk. We're still in Norfolk, okay. In Norfolk, good. And we had a lovely time, and we had these talks about Jesus, and I'm thrilled. You're on fire because you've been a weekend away. So you say, the preacher was saying that I'm loved by God like a child. And that I've just been dwelling on that. But you know what? I'd love to have had a wife. It's lovely seeing the families playing. But I would so long to be married. But I would long to have children. And it becomes the but after every good thing. Do you know what I mean? It's the grid through that disappointment is the grid through which all of life is filtered. Just before we do that, I think one thing as well that's hard is in our culture is the problem of success. That you, maybe you're thinking, well, I've got what I wanted. I see this actually. I see it among my friends who aren't Christians, a sort of despair. I'm 42. Guys around my age have midlife crises, and I think disappointment is why. Mine was about a year ago. I think that it's, you look at your life and you think, well, I've got the job I wanted. And maybe there'll be one promotion before I retire because I've done pretty well, and now I'll be doing the same job for the next 30 years. I'm married, and marriage is okay, but this is it now for the next 30 years. I like the kids, but this is it. I've got them. I've got the house. I've got the car. I've achieved everything I want, and now I've got another 30 years to live it out, and nothing's going to change. And that's why some people press the big red button and buy a Porsche or a Harley Davidson or a new wife, or a new job. Some people, it's just the drink, or the drugs. Amazing middle-aged drug use in villages in Norfolk. It's in the church, it probably looks a bit different. We probably, in God's grace, have some wisdom not to press as many big red buttons, although sometimes we do. But there can be just a despair, a despondency that creeps in. Because you see it kind of in acute form among athletes that go bonkers after they retire. I remember hearing an interview with a rower, I don't remember who it was, after he'd won several Olympic golds. And he spoke very honestly just of the terror of waking up the day after winning an Olympic gold medal, thinking, what on earth is my life about now? Because you can't get higher than that. I can come back in 4 years and match it, maybe, but there will be a point where I can't match it because there's someone younger and fitter. And the only way is down. success does not mean you're not disappointed. I'd like just take a few moments. Don't necessarily talk about this. Just for yourself, I've put a little box that says consider. And the idea is consider personally. But just take a few moments. Think, what in your life do you think maybe you should be more disappointed about? And what maybe should you be less disappointed about? In the light of what we've just said. And I'll just give you a few minutes to think about that. If you want to jot something down to pray about later, then do. If you want to just think about it, that's fine. But have a little think. Well, if you'd like to turn to the second side of the handout, I'm going to give three things that might help us to put disappointment in its right place. We don't want to remove it in one sense, because we should be disappointed about some things, but we want to put it in its right place. The first is hope that destroys despair. And the book of Ecclesiastes ends in quite a strange place. Let me read you just right at the end of it. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Let me read from verse 13. The end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And I think what's interesting, and the New Testament pushes further than this, but where Solomon lands is the way to re-establish meaning in a meaningless world is to remember that every deed will be brought into judgment. So the weight of our lives is not measured in the terms of our society. So you might be disappointed because you never achieved the grades at school that meant you could go on and train as a nurse. And you'd love to have done that, but you just didn't get the grades and you never could. And you work in a shop instead, and you just feel disappointed every day as you go to work. And Solomon says, well, God will bring everything you do today into judgment. And he won't consider it worthless because you're not a nurse. He will judge it on his criteria. Everything you do matters. There is a wonderful hope in that I didn't mess it up when I messed up my A-levels or my GCSEs. I didn't mess it up when I messed up my marriage and got divorced. It didn't end when I retired and I stopped being someone and became no one. It didn't end because actually the but is not, but I wish I was married, or but I wish I had that job. The but is, but Jesus is coming back, and he will be the one who judges my life. Not you and not me. So there is a hope that the future matters. I might be, one day most of us will be in a retirement home, not able to go out, and feeling pretty useless and pretty despairing. And Ecclesiastes says, well, Jesus will bring everything you do today into judgment. He is concerned about everything you do today, even if most of it is sleep or be fed. He cares. And it suddenly just says, actually, our best days are not behind us. In his eyes, we haven't just messed it up in a way that can never be brought back or redeemed. He goes, no, I care. I care about today. And he gives us a purpose. I don't know if you saw it. A few years back, there was an advert that there was a guy sitting at his desk in an office block, in a sort of big office building. And he was just clearly bored out of his mind. and he starts playing with a little Star Wars toy he's got on his desk. And he's reminiscing about how he and his friend used to play Star Wars. And particularly about how they would play at being sort of Jedi Knights, or how they'd turn their bikes into X-Wing fighters and race around the place. And all of a sudden, he hears a noise outside the window, and an X-Wing fighter rises up outside his kind of big glass office block window. And the cockpit pops open, and it's his mate from childhood who waves at him. And then another X-Wing pops up, and the cockpit opens, and it's empty. And his mate's like, come on! And he throws his chair through the window and jumps into the X-Wing fighter, and they zoom off. And it's an advert for a computer game, flying X-Wing fighters. And now, none of us thought that we would save the galaxy from an evil empire. But actually, we sort of did, didn't we? I remember when I worked in Manchester, and we had lots of students in the church, lots of young people, and so much lay before them, getting their first flat of their own, getting their first job, buying their first flat, going out with somebody, getting married, raising a family. The world offered a lot of genuinely good things. And on top of that, they'd been told that they could do whatever they wanted. If they believed in themselves, they could live their dreams. And you hear this, you hear athletes interviewed, and I remember hearing a sprinter, I don't know if it was Usain Bolt, someone very good being interviewed, and they asked, well, what makes you so good? It's like, well, it's all about your mental stamina, and you have to visualize yourself winning, and you have to be mentally strong and robust. And I'm sure that's true, but I could line up next to Usain Bolt and I could visualize myself crossing the finishing line before him, and I guarantee it would not happen. And he could be wearing a suit of armor and it wouldn't happen. It's not all in the mind. Some of it is in the muscle. And that we just can't be whatever we want. But that is the lie that is sold to children. It's well-meaning. And there's something in it, to have confidence to try things. That's the kind of thing teachers are trying to do. There's something in that. But, I'm meeting to read the Bible with a lovely teenage lad from church. And I think we're unpicking some of this. That he's facing, what does he do next? Does he do an apprenticeship? Does he do a course of study? And actually, part of what I'm trying to do is gently say to him, you can't be whatever you want. Because that isn't actually how the world works. But I'm also trying to say to him, God doesn't care that much, because he has a better purpose for you than conquering an evil galactic empire or being a champion tennis player or whatever it is. John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35, I think we'll go for. John chapter 13, verse 34, Jesus is speaking. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Jesus calls us to love. And he gives us a purpose that the world cannot take away. It doesn't matter whether I am prime minister of the country or a cleaner in McDonald's. I can love those I am with. And I cannot do so more because I am CEO of a FTSE 100 company, or because I have won Wimbledon. It doesn't increase my capacity. Andy Murray has 24 hours in which he can love people, and so do I. That is what Christ calls us to do. It's written throughout the scriptures. We go to loads of verses. You see it worked out in places like 1 Peter 2 and 3. What does Christ want you to do if you're a slave? He wants you to be a slave who loves his master. What does he want you to do if you're a husband? He wants you to be a husband who loves his wife. What does he want you to do if you're a child? He wants you to be a child who obeys her parents. It's worked out in all of life. It's love. Worked out in relationships. We went to McDonald's years ago now, and my little girl, Daisy, saw a lady cleaning the tables, and she said, "That's a really good job. Because she cleans all the tables, we don't have to, so we can come here, and we can enjoy a really nice meal in this cafe." And her job means that must be loads of people all day who get to enjoy a nice meal on a clean table because she does her job. And I thought, you know, from the mouths of babes and infants, you see more wisely than I do. I see a rubbish minimum wage job. You see an opportunity to love people. And Daisy's right, isn't she? That's the way Christ sees it. And then, thirdly, we have a perspective that shrinks disappointment. I love Peter's first letter. The way he starts off, he says, I may as well turn them and actually quote it rather than try and remember. "To those who are elect exiles of the dispersion." We are scattered. We are dispersed across the world. We are the elect of God, and he has chosen that we be exiles, strangers and sojourners. This world is not our home. This is not our life. This world is passing, and Christ is coming back. And there is a day when all our disappointments will be put into perspective by the return of Jesus Christ. And we will leave the shadowlands, and we will breathe the good air of Narnia. And that won't be that important, because we will see the face of Christ. And my guess is that we will fall on our knees, and he will draw us to himself, and he will lift our faces, and we will see his smile. And he will say, "Well done, good, faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master. And now I'd like to take you to meet my father." That is our future. It will not be disappointing. And every disappointment along the way, I don't know how he will redeem any of them. But he will redeem them, and we will see how he used them, and it will be marvelous to us. I've only got a couple of minutes till quarter two when we're due to finish. I put another discussion question and then something to consider, which I thought we might do when we finish. So why don't you take just 5 minutes to do that, to sort of talk together in your little groups. How does this view of our hope, our purpose, and the perspective of Christ's return help us to endure disappointment? We can consider work and family life and friendship. And then some of you might need to head off to look after little ones or whatever at quarter two. We'll finish at quarter two, but I'm happy to stick around and answer some questions if things come up in the group discussion. So we can do that. So why don't we spend the last 5 minutes just in groups discussing that second, and then the last consider, I was thinking, would probably be a good thing to do afterwards anyway, and you can do that whenever you get some space. But yeah, 5 minutes to discuss that last discuss box. It's quarter to six, and I don't want to detain you longer. If you need to get away, so please do feel free to leave if you need to. But if anyone would like to ask any questions for what we've been discussing, I'd be happy to do that as well. So if there are any questions, then we can do that. If not, we can just finish. Is there anything anyone wanted to ask? Yeah.
Purpose that cuts off escape. What did you mean by that cuts off escape?
Oh, yes. I sort of cut that out a bit. And I probably shouldn't have. I just had too much material. So I think our tendency is to... When we feel like there's no purpose in life, we feel like we've sort of either we've had it, you know, it's gone too far, it will just be disappointing, I'll never get the job I wanted, or we feel we've achieved what we wanted and now it's just ongoing. So when we feel life lacks purpose, our tendency is to escape. So that can be TV box sets, it can be ages buying things on Amazon, it can be, it's kind of we distract. We live in an entertainment culture, so we distract with entertainment or with leisure. It can be, these things, most of them aren't bad in themselves. Some of them are, if you turn to drugs or something, but a lot of them are good things, or a hobby. You find people who sort of live for their hobby. And again, often the hobby is a good thing. Hobbies can be a wonderful blessing and opportunity for relaxation and socializing and all sorts. But we meet people sort of who are, I guess I know more men, but guys who are kind of like obsessed with their bike and they're forever on the internet, you know, getting the latest new brakes for their bike or whatever it is. And they time themselves assiduously on their incredibly expensive gadgets to see how long it takes them to ride 100 kilometers. And I'm not really, it's not, there's nothing wrong in it. I enjoy riding my bike. And some people like gadgets and things, and that's fine. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's why it's quite subtle. But there becomes a point at which you think, I think this is your life. It's not a hobby that you enjoy. It's really what your life is about. And I think it's hard to know for others. For yourself, you know, what goes through your mind as you're waiting for the bus? Is it always this thing? I mean, for some, the escape can be work. Family's tricky, so they throw themselves into their work. Or the other way around, work's tricky, so they throw themselves into their family. Mostly it's good things, particularly as Christians, because the bad things are more obvious to us. We know that if we're downing two bottles of Chardonnay every night, there's probably a problem. But it's harder to tell if I enjoy following my team or if I'm working hard. Well, we're meant to work hard. We're meant to work as those who serve the Lord. But I think we can know, am I glad when I have to work away because bath time is just such hard work? There's things that tell us. So it's quite subtle, the escape thing, because what could be, and often it's something that is a good thing in our lives that becomes a god. So often the thing has been good and then becomes, well, it's quite interesting that bit in Hebrews where the writer of the Hebrews says, throw off every sin and every weight that encumbers. There can be things that encumber our life that are not sins. But they are encumbrances. Does that help? I'm sorry, I should have addressed that. Thank you. That was a great question. Appreciate it.